Well, good evening, everyone. Once again, it's been an amazing and fascinating experience to be around these two folks as we listen to their stories and comprehend what life was like back in those days. This isn't a particularly scripted event, and you'll be hearing their thoughts as they relive some of those. So we'll start out with, where do you live? We'll have Laura.
Okay, when we first came to Homer, of course we came here, forget the Baycrest. Nobody was dreaming of it then. And we stayed in a cabin, backside of Prosman Ridge, facing Olson Mountain. Then when we actually had a homestead, 160 acres.
Okay, Steve, can you work your way up there?
First of all, I'm here for my great-grandparents, grandparents, and my mom and dad on both sides of my family. They were the ones that came here and homesteaded this when it was a long time ago. My family came here in 1892 to Kenai, and they worked at the Libby McNeil and Libby Canry in Kenai. Then my great-grandfather, Henry Lindstrang, came from Finland to the United States. To get his American citizenship, he fought for Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War. And after the war was over, they sent all the Finlanders to Danville, Wyoming, and my great-grandfather was a fisherman. Well, that didn't work very well. So we don't know how he got to San Francisco, but somehow he got to San Francisco and came to Alaska. He fished out in Cook Inlet here, and they delivered in Saldovia, and they delivered salt fish. That was the only way to preserve the fish in those days. But he liked what he saw, and somehow he got across to what they called the colonies, and he went up the beach to Starisky, and there was a Russian kid by the name, we don't know what his real name was, we don't know anything about him, other than he was a Russian national and he couldn't own any land. And my great-grandfather told him he was going to homestead at Starisky there, and that Mr. Rickard could live there. He lived there his whole life until he passed away in 1954. Nobody knows how old he was. Nobody knows anything about him. My grandfather homesteaded there, and when he married my grandmother, he bought this homestead from my great-grandfather, Henry Lindstrang.
There's a fish trap.
What's that?
A fish trap.
I'm sorry. most people don't understand how a fish trap worked, and it was the most efficient way to catch fish that ever was as far as salmon goes. You could drop an apron and turn the fish loose. Our fish trap was a private owned trap. About 95% of the traps in the state of Alaska were company owned. And when I say company owned, they were owned by Seattle. The way the fish trap works is the fish can either come, this would be north and that would be south. They come up, they hit this lead, they come down the lead, and hopefully they go into the tunnel, and then this was the heart, and then the fish would swim around in the heart. The interesting thing about that was that the pink salmon was on the surface, they swam clockwise. What we called the money fish was the king salmon, the red salmon, and the silver salmon would be underneath them, and they'd swim counterclockwise. So what, on a pink year, when the canneries had all the pinks they needed, they wouldn't buy our pink salmon. So we'd have to let them go. So what you'd do is you'd drop an apron, depending on which way the current was running, you'd let the fish swim away until you got down to the money fish. Now you always ended up with pink salmon because you never want a money fish to swim away. When I was a kid, the price of king salmon were $5 a piece for king salmon over 15 pounds. $2.50 a piece for king salmon under 15 pounds. Red salmon were 45 cents a piece. Silver salmon were a quarter, two bits. That's the price when I was a kid. And then when I was a kid, 1959, We became a state and we outlawed the traps. And that was the biggest reason we became a state, because of the control of all the fisheries were in Seattle and the last one to have control of their fisheries. The bad thing about that was we didn't get a set net site. There was 4 traps in the whole state of Alaska that didn't get to keep on fishing, and we were one of them. I have little use for the government. Okay, our fish trap was a hand trap. The way that worked is all these pilings that went out on the lead out to the low water mark were guy wired off, and it was made out of chicken wire. Now, from the low water mark out the heart and the wings on that each side, that was all web. And you had to keep those clean 24 hours a day. It was very labor intensive. What would happen is a big bunch of kelp would wash down here, wash into the lead of the trap, it would blow the lead of the trap out and the trap would quit fishing. We had whales that used to come up and lay alongside the lead of the trap and go to sleep. The trap quit fishing, believe me. Sea lion would get in the trap, they'd get into the heart of the trap, just cause hate and discontent. Big halibut, I'm talking about, 200-pound halibut would get in the tunnel and get in the trap. So it was basically a 24-hour job, 7 days a week. Now, the one thing about the trap, when the fish get in there and you get too many fish in there, then you can shut the tunnel off. That's about all I got on that subject.
All right. Laura, what inspired your family to come to Alaska, and how did they get here?
Well, we were all born in Washington State, and that's where we were living. My dad worked construction jobs, so he'd be gone for months at a time. When my brother was about 4 years old, Robert, my dad came home from a long job, and he asked Mother, "What is he doing here?" After that, the goal was that we would be together. The next season, 1941, my dad got a job in Kodiak helping build the naval base. He saved up money and sent for us. And while he's working at the base, there were a lot of Homer men working over there, and he, of course, talked to them. So we took a 2-week vacation and came to Homer on the Alaska steamship, of course. We didn't swim. We walked all over the place. There weren't many vehicles here anyway, but we didn't have one, so. And then noticed that the green grass, the native grass, just grew like crazy in that 2 weeks. Homer apparently appeared in their binoculars at that time then. Well, in the fall, we went back to Washington State. My brother was starting school, so we had to be back there. And then World War II. Women and children were not allowed into Alaska until 1945. We're on the first boat that they let women and children come, and we arrived in Homer for real in June of 1945. And that's, somebody drove us out to that cabin on Crosman Ridge where we were gonna be staying. Of course, you go to the store to get some groceries and whoops, we're on the first ship of the season. What do you suppose is in the grocery store? There's some flour and sugar and a few odds and ends. So for the first few days, we had pancakes for breakfast, hot cakes for lunch, griddle cakes for supper. Oh, let's have hot cakes the next morning. And we rotated that until the boat got unloaded and we could get some real groceries. And they did some more walking around to find a place with a as much open land as they could, because, gosh, we got to raise cattle with all that grass. So they found a place on Diamond Ridge. My dad filed on it. And there was a 12 by 13 foot cabin on the property that someone had filed on it, and they never proved up. And so the cabin was there, and my dad bought stuff from the guy, and he had the cabin. So that first winter, we're living on Crosman Ridge. We're going to move to Diamond Ridge, but we're going to build a house that summer. And my dad didn't have anything to do that winter except ski over to Diamond Ridge, batch in that cabin for 4 or 5 days at a time, go out on his snowshoes with a two-man crosscut saw. Chainsaws? Forget that. Two-man crosscut saw and a double-bedded axe. He spent the winter going back and forth and going out in the woods, and when he got through, he'd cut down his 100 trees. That was his goal. So he cut 100 trees that winter. And meanwhile, my mother was probably worrying herself sick when he was gone several days, and she had no way of knowing if maybe a tree fell on him or something. So I think that was a hard winter for her. And of course, my brother and I had to ski to school. We got snowed in on Thanksgiving, and our only transportation at that point in time was a Ford tractor, skis, and snowshoes. So we're snowed in, we skied. My brother and I didn't know how to ski. My dad didn't know how to ski, except what he'd seen in a movie short sometime. So he took a long rope, and my brother and I each grabbed onto the rope, and he towed us up the hill to the top of Crosman Ridge and turned us loose, and we slid down to school. And of course, recess, lunch hour, whenever we had a minute, we were out there on those skis learning how to really use them. Well, school's out in the evening. We're trying to get up that hill, and I didn't tell you about the skis. They were like 6 foot long and heavy. They call them old army skis. We were struggling. My dad comes with the rope and tows us to the top of the hill, and we slide home. The night we met him at the top of the hill ended our ski tow. Spring finally came. The 1st of June, 1946, someone with a Caterpillar tractor plowed the road out to our cabin so that we could move to Diamond Ridge. And I remember these huge chunks of snow off the side of the road that they dozed off to open the road. It didn't take long to thaw off after that, but that was pretty deep snow. There was a song on the radio. There weren't much regular program in the daytime, but they had call-in music shows. And somebody would call in. They wanted him to play Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow. And finally, the announcer would say, Weatherman, please don't take heed. And then he would play their song.
So, Steve, you kind of told us about your family, why they got here. What inspired them to come here? And how did they get here? Is there more to that?
I told you how my great-grandparents my great-grandfather got up here. But my grandmother came up in 1914. When she was 10 years old, she was born in 1903. My great-grandparents and my grandparents on my mother's side came in 1938 out east, and they homesteaded where the golf course is today. They actually homesteaded five homesteads, 560-acre pieces out there, basically from the
to the top of the hill.
My great-grandparents on that side, they had raised vegetables and stuff. Potatoes is a crop, but on my father's side, it was strictly fishing. They all came up here. My dad was born at Steriski, and my aunt was born there in Seward. My grandmother went to Seward to have my aunt. My dad's side of the family has all been fishermen and mariners.
So one thing we didn't talk about is, did you have any brothers and sisters? This could take a while.
Wetmore, I don't want to get into that too far. Yeah, I've got a bunch of brothers and sisters.
Okay. It's interesting when I ask these guys, what kind of equipment did you guys have around the homestead? Steve?
Ford tractor.
Laura?
Ford tractor.
Okay, so we pretty much covered all the equipment that you had around the homestead. Laura, tell us about your cabin. You know, you kind of told us about the school a little bit, but there's a few stories about the cabin, like the clearing and the roots and air under the cabin.
You know, when we came up, we're talking about my mother and dad were gonna raise cattle. We got snowed in on Thanksgiving and plowed out in June. They were out of the cattle business before we got moved on to the homestead. When we first got here, eggs were called boat eggs. They come up in the freight part of the boat. There was no refrigeration. Some of them could be quite flavorful. My mother, every egg she cracked into a separate bowl. And she used some in cooking and some went out the door. We're not going to do cattle. We have to have something to make a living. We raised chickens. Almost every homesteader that came up here was like on their last nickel. They had to, man or the whole family had to work out somewhere in the summer to make money to work on this free homestead to get it to follow the regs to prove up. Well, my parents had sold a house and 10 acres in Washington before we came up, so they had a nest egg. And the first 2 years, Mother talked about going down to the post office on income tax day and borrowing a red pen from the postmaster because she didn't have a red pen. So when you filled out a tax return where you lost money, you had to use red ink to fill that. And she did that for a couple of years. So then we have eggs. Okay, we started out. First summer, we got a cow with a calf and a dozen chickens, and we didn't have time to go fishing. There was work to do. My dad sawed up those 100 trees, except he only found 99. He never found the 100th one. And they sawed them into lumber and built a house. Actually, it was supposed to be the brooder house, and we'd build a house later, but later never came. The next year, we had 50 chickens. That's a good start. They were brown. So the hawks thought they looked like dinner. I remember Mother out in the chicken pen with a potato hook chasing the hawk off while my dad went home to get the shotgun. We went up to a couple hundred chickens, 500 chickens. At the end, we had 1,000 laying hens on Diamond Ridge, supplied eggs all the way to Seward. Oh, yes. Remember the pancake story? How would you like scrambled eggs for breakfast, fried eggs for lunch, and boiled eggs for dinner? You know, it just, there's a more of a variety there.
Laura, was your house warm?
It was built on a side hill, and the wind would come up underneath, and it was one layer of floorboards. My dad put it might have been the canvas from the tent we slept in that summer by the 12 by 13 building that we cooked and ate in. There was boxes on that tarp to help keep it from blowing away. The walls, they had this new invention of insulation, accordion-like, and you pull it up open between the studs, and there's a layer of aluminum foil, nice, thin aluminum foil, and you're using rough-cut lumber? And then there was a layer of real heavy paper and then a layer of aluminum on the inside. So that was supposed to give you these two wonderful air pockets for insulation, but it was impossible to put it up without punching some holes in. So essentially the house wasn't insulated. Folks were getting ready to come up. Mother went to a store to buy a cooking range, and she wanted a good one. And it had to be a wood and coal combination. Salesman was showing off how strong the oven was by standing on the oven door.
So one of the things that I thought was fascinating when we were talking about this stuff was, I'm sure everybody's familiar with the big rolling firewood meadows down below her homestead up on Diamond Ridge. Tell us what they found when they were digging in those meadows.
Let me finish the oven story first. Sometimes the wind would come from the north, it would come down. And if the stove weren't nice and hot, the wind would come down the chimney and blow the smoke all over the house. And it's a heck of a time trying to get the house warmed up. So here's my brother and I with our coats on. We probably had our wool socks on too, but we didn't have our shoes on because we were sitting on the oven door with our feet in the oven. And that really helped. So anyway, yeah, we had this grassland. We did raise a few cattle. You can just cultivate it and start growing stuff. Except that many long years ago, this area was forested. So my dad would get out there with a tiller and he'd run into sticks and he'd run into roots. And this stuff was buried and it takes forever to rot. So we did a lot of what they call picking sticks to clear the land. And you had to clear, and 160 acres, you had to clear 20 acres and have it in cultivation and have a habitable house in the first 3 years you're there. So I don't know what a habitable house really is, but we lived in that one.
So Steve, tell us about your cabin.
The first Trieste house was built in 1908, and I might be wrong on that, but somewhere in that vicinity. After my grandfather married my grandmother, he built what I still to this day call the house. It's a 24 by 24 log cabin, dovetailed. I thought that house was a mansion. I really did. It was pretty fancy. We had a coal stove downstairs, heated the upstairs, and we had a storm porch. That was the house that I kind of grew up in, and then later on I lived with my grandmother at the Homer Cash store in Homer, which is now the Coast Guard offices. My grandfather and Carl Rosenberg, and there was several other gentlemen that built that store. Charlie Sharp from across from Seldovia, which sold, everything was in Seldovia when I was a kid. The hospital was there, the courthouse, the mail, the post office. Seldovia was a big town, and I might not have these figures right, but I think there was around 800 people in Seldovia year-round and about 1,500 in the summertime. My grandmother and grandfather wanted to start a store on what they called the Colonies side. And so Charlie Sharp more or less financed the store, and then my grandmother paid the store off later on. That's how the first store got to be in Homer. Back to Strisky, we had a root cellar, a walk-in root cellar you could walk right into. We cut ice out of Strisky Creek in the wintertime and then put it in the root cellar in the summer for the summer months, covered up with sawdust, and you could walk in there, and it was like 34, 35 degrees. It was really nice. We obviously harvested a lot of fish from the fish trap and from Strisky Creek. I did anyway. And we either salted the fish because there was no electricity in those days. I don't think Laura had electricity up on the hill for a long, long time. Speaking of that, we called her hillbillies, and we were fishermen, but she called us beach rats. Let's see, where was I at in the scheme of things here? Her transportation was different than ours. The beach was our road. We used the tractor on the beach. We'd leave Strisky a couple hours after high water and get to Homer. Usually stop a couple places on the way, but usually get there 8 hours later, which I, when you're a little kid, you think that's forever. You'll never hear me complain about road construction. The very first time I rode to Anchorage in a car, it took 2 days. Seriously, it took 2 days. We made it as far as Hinton's Lodge, which is now where the ferry for the Russian River is. We spent the night there, and then the next day we went on into Anchorage.
The next thing I had was, how did you get your food? Do you have some more to add to that?
So you got your staples, after that first summer. You could go to Mrs. Wally's store and put in your order. And the USDA had a booklet of how much of flour, how much sugar, etc., a family of four would need. And we were the perfect family of four. So that made it a little easier to figure out what to order. Order in the fall, then the ship came in with everything aboard, and it's probably gonna be the last ship before freeze up or something, or at least before we get snowed in. Take the groceries home. A case of graham crackers. Okay, there's 12 boxes. There's six wrapped up in brown paper, and there's six more in another brown paper, and it's all in a cardboard box. So we open the box, and the brown paper is all stamped, Alaska, Alaska. What's that all about? So we open the box of graham crackers, and they were all just a little bit scorched. And do you think we were going to send them back and go without all year? No, they knew in Seattle that if they sent it to Alaska, it wouldn't come back. The time crunch would take care of that. And then we did have a garden, and a lot of people, when they talk about what did you raise in the garden, I never think to say potatoes, because that was a crop. You don't call your half acre of potatoes garden. You call it a lot of hard work. And of course, like I said, we had plenty of eggs. And then there's a case of the chickens. I don't know how many of you know how to tell a layer from a liar in the chicken ranch, but we had leghorns, so they were easy to deal with. If they're laying, their legs are pale. If they're lying, their legs are bright yellow, and they might as well go in the pot. And there's another way, the pelvic bones, if you can stick two fingers between them and at least three between the two pelvic bones and the end of the breastbone, then they're laying. Otherwise, if the bones have kind of pulled together more, they're lying.
The chores. Laura, I'll give this back to you. It sounds like the eggs were your chores. You got more chores to brag about?
We didn't call them chores. I guess setting the table for dinner was a chore because we always did that when we came home from school. School was an interesting thing. The first year we skied up the hill and down the other side to the original Homer Heights school. And the next year there weren't enough kids on Crosman Ridge for a school. You had to have six. There were six of us on Diamond Ridge. They moved the Homer Heights school over to Diamond Ridge. There was my brother, Robert, and I. I was 8 and he was 9 when we came to Alaska. But anyway, for fourth grade on the homestead, there was my brother and I. There was a kid named Skippy Tweeden who lived about 2 miles east of us. And then the family of Phillips had 3 kids, and they were only like half a mile west of us, so they didn't have to walk forever to get to school. We had school in that 12 by 13 cabin. My dad was a janitor. The teacher lived with us. They were building the house in a hurry. So they put, instead of upright studs, they put crosswise, I don't know what you call them, and the boards were vertical. And when we moved into the house, the ends weren't finished. They were in from the side, but there was a gap in the middle. So the next morning, the school teacher says she thought a bear walked through the house in the middle of the night. My folks were sure it was just somebody got up to go out back. The next winter, we didn't have enough kids on the hill for school, and my grandfather was sick, so mother and us kids went to Washington for the winter. Came back up on Alaska Steamship. Then the following year, they had finally built the Sterling Highway. So we had to ski, sled, or walk, depending on the snow conditions, for about 1.75 miles to get to the bus stop. And the bus was supposed to be there at a certain time. And if we were late, he had to wait 10 minutes. That was the rule. We really marched to get down there some days. One spring breakup, in the morning the ground would be frozen, and at night you'd slosh through the mud. Well, that morning it wasn't frozen, and we came sloshing around the corner right when the bus was supposed to leave, but he saw us and stayed and gave us a big lecture about not being on time, the only time we were late. I always say they hadn't invented sand yet. So it had snowed and snowpack, and then it rained, and Baycrest Hill was glare ice. And of course, the bus has chains on, but still, it was real icy. You may have noticed these big fills on the road, or you may not have, because there's lots of trees and stuff on the sides of the fill now, but they were deep canyons and they filled them. No guardrail, nothing. So the bus stopped. We all got out and marched across to the other side of the fill. The bus came, picked us up, took us to the next fill. We marched across again, and they took us off to school. One time we had this horrendous spring March storms, heavy wet snow. Normally, there were 2 buses in Homer. One went out East Road. The other one went to the airport to take the kids whose parents worked there and came back. So we got out of school at 3:30. The bus normally picked us up at 10 minutes to 4 and dropped us off up on the hill. And we would get home in time to listen to the Lone Ranger on the radio. And this particular day, the big storm had hit and they sent our bus out early. They sent us out at afternoon recess. And they got up to the ranger station up there where Alaska Hardy is now. That's approximately where the bus stopped. We got out, and he turned around and went home. He couldn't go any farther. We started walking. We got just a little ways, and somebody in a pickup lived in Anchor Point stopped to give us a ride. We hadn't a clue who it was, and we didn't care. We got in. He took us up, and he took us just a little ways up Diamond Ridge Road, and okay, that's it. So we walked all the way home. Now, we'd gotten out from the school real early, and we're walking up the hill, the second hill above the cemetery. Well, we're actually between those two hills. It's about where the old funeral home was. And we got our heads bowed down, and we're marching, and the snow's getting deeper and deeper, and it's really hard to walk. Finally glanced up, the snow was coming at us, and that tree shouldn't be there. It should be over there. So we took a left, walked out of the ditch, and went on home. And we got home at 5 o'clock and got to hear the Lone Ranger.
Okay, Steve, your chores, besides opening Starisky Creek to fishing every other week all year long?
When I was old enough to operate a pair of hog ring pliers, my job was to patch the lead on the trap and to keep the kelp off. But everybody did that too, but that was my particular chores. As far as chores go, packing water every morning and packing 2 buckets of water, 2 buckets of coal every morning. No running water in the wintertime. We had to pack our water, and we mined the coal. I didn't mine the coal. My parents and my uncle and Mr. Rickard, and they would mine the coal out of Starisky Creek, and then we put it in the coal shed, and then I packed it from the coal shed to the house.
So I just have to hear this one. Did you guys ever see that fabled 100-pound king salmon in that fish trap?
Every year we'd get. Now, you got to remember that there was no scales back there in those days, and the fish were sold as individual fish. But every year we'd get at least one, sometimes several 100-pound king salmon in the trap. When I say that, the trap tendermen, everybody would say, well, that's a fish over 100 pounds. And believe me, I've got a picture somewhere. My wife puts things away where they're safe. So a lot of these things are real safe, believe me. But anyway, I have a picture of my uncle and my dad with a king salmon. My dad was 5'10 at that time. And my uncle was 6 foot, and that fish pole, it was on a pole between them, and they were on their shoulders, and the fish head, it went through the gills of the fish, and the tail of the fish was laying on the ground.
So Steve, what happened if you guys had a medical emergency? What did you guys do?
Best way I can describe that is my grandfather in 1937 was falling a tree up at Starisky. Tree fell on him, and he busted his spleen. He walked to Homer, got the mail boat to Seldovia, got the big mail boat to Seward, got on the train, and died on his way to Anchorage. I was born in the Harrington cabin, which is now up at the museum. My grandkids say that I'm ancient because I was born in a museum. My mother didn't get to Seldovia to the hospital.
We had a sled. It hadn't gotten enough coal in the fall, so there was a pile of coal at the top of our driveway, and we were supposed to be hauling coal down to the house in these boxes that were on the sleds. But I talked him into, let's take a little run down the road first. He got too close to the edge and fell over and reached his hand out to stop him, and he hurt his wrist and didn't know how bad. So he ran around with his arm in a sling for a week or so, and my dad ended up getting a plane, fly them over to Seldovia, and went to the doctor there, and he x-rayed it and said it was a real bad break. And you could get it fixed in Anchorage, but I recommend Virginia Mason in Seattle. Of course, we had tons of relatives in Seattle. So he got the reservation. He's going to fly out on PNA, Pacific Northern Airlines, on a certain day. It was spring. The hill that hill, that's first hill above the cemetery. My dad was driving it was an old Army four-wheel drive truck, pickup truck. He had chains all around, and he got stuck going down that hill because the bottom had gone out. I don't remember, but I'm guessing somebody came along and pulled us out about that time, because we got to the airport 30 minutes after that plane was supposed to be gone. But this was Alaska, and this was in the 40s, and the plane waited half an hour for a half fare passenger to head for Seattle. And if you had a toothache, I guess you'd get a neighbor to take it out with his pliers or something, because we did not have a resident dentist either. And I spent some time on the MS hygiene. The doctor there pulled one of my teeth, and Novocaine doesn't work very well. I got in trouble for screaming. But then later dentists would come down from Anchorage after the road was finished. Actually, there was one in Coho, Dr. Pollard, yeah. And he had one of those wonderful treadle drills. If you've seen a treadle sewing machine, it works on the same principle. But he's got to be treadling at a reasonable rate, and if he gets distracted and slows down, that dull old drill blade catches in your tooth, and... Yeah, okay.
I got a comment about Dr. Pollard. He was about 70 years old. So, you know, he ran out of steam pretty quick.
Also, the last time I saw him, apparently he was getting a little forgetful, too, because I don't think the needles had to be sharpened. They didn't use a new needle on you. And apparently they weren't autoclaved well enough, and I had a little infection bump everywhere where he stuck the needle in.
So here we have Steve calling a 70-year-old dentist old. I'm just saying. So now I wanted to call this the funny part, but they want me to call it unusual stories. And one day I was out trolling with Steve again, and we're over by Yukon and near Eldridge Passage entrance, and he looks at this big rock that sticks up there and has a light on it, and he says, you know, I tried to move that one day. And of course, there's going to be a Steve Wally story behind that one.
Well, I think you've seen some pictures of the Celtic up there. This was a salmon tender, and we'd been about 7 days going full bore, and my youngest little brother there, he was working for me on the boat at the time. So I let him get 8 hours sleep, and we had 22,000 fish on board the boat at the time. And we come out of Tutka Bay there and lined up on the Homer Spit, which is, you can see, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, flat calm, sunshine, and beautiful day. And I told my little brother, I says, now just keep her headed at the spit, and when we get a mile off the spit, wake me up. I woke up, believe me, I woke up. We hit that rock doing 11 knots with 22,000 fish on board. We took 17 feet of the bow off of it. And Philip Broody was going by in the skiff. He saw it all happen. He came over, I put the crew on the skiff, and I stood outside of the wheelhouse there with a remote control for the steering, put the boat in gear, and we made it to the end of the Homer Spit and in the harbor, and offloaded all the fish and offloaded all the equipment and everything. And then that night we put it on the grid, and we put a big patch on it, sat in the harbor for a couple of days. The insurance come down, told the boat, boat was towed to Halibut Cove, and the rest of the boat was stripped out and taken out into about 6 miles off of Flat Island, and the Coast Guard used it for target practice.
I'm guessing there wasn't a navigation light on it until Steve.
No, it was there
before. A light?
Yeah.
Okay. Laura, do you have a chicken egg story?
So we got chickens from Seattle, and they were flown in, and they'd land at the airport, but at that point, we didn't have a telephone. We, you know, Morse code doesn't work very well without some kind of connection. So they would send somebody out in a small plane to drop a note out of the plane, and we'd run out in the hayfield and find it. And, oh, your chickens are here, okay. So my dad would head for the truck, and they'd know he got the note. Well, one time, the plane came over, and they dropped the note, and we looked and looked. We never did find that note. So the plane circled around, and it came in low, and Bob Turkington leans out and yells, "Your chickens are here!"
The Tundra Telegraph. Okay, so we've got time for a few more unusual stories. So Steve, you got some sort of bullet hole story to tell?
Was it the story? I know. Well, I was about 10 years old, and I was hunting rabbits up, and I had this 1903 Pump 22, and I shot at this rabbit. And I missed. Didn't miss my often, but that time I missed. So anyway, so the way you took the 22 apart, you have to unscrew it and pull the butt off of it, and then you could clear the gun and go back to hunting again. Well, got over, and there was a fallen down tree, and I sat down on the tree, and I laid the gun down, and the damn thing went off. Well, I was wearing shoe packs and on my right leg there, it hurt. And I goes, uh-oh. So I took my shoe pack off and I took my socks down, and there's a bullet hole in me. So I goes, oh boy, I can't tell anybody about this. They're going to take that 22 away from me. So I go home and I hobble around a little bit, and they ask me, oh, what are you hobbling for? Oh, I fell down. A couple of weeks later or something, I forgot about it. I literally forgot about it. So I went in the service, and when you go in the service, you got to write. They ask you, I think the question was, you got any foreign objects in your body? And I goes, bullet hole, or bullet in right leg. No, didn't think much about it. So pretty soon I get called out of my company and up to the infirmary. And I walk in there, and this flight surgeon's sitting there, and he's looking at this piece of paper, and he says, Seaman Wally, he says, it says here in that you have a bullet in your right leg. And I got one, yeah. He says, and I could tell right away, this guy didn't believe me. So he says, well, let me see it. So I lifted up my bell bottoms, and he felt around in there. He says, there is something in there. He says, I guess we'll have to have you x-rayed. So I went in, they x-rayed me. I came out, and I don't know how long it was. It wasn't very long after that that everybody come charging out. About five or six people come charging out, and they got a hold of me, and they put me on a gurney, and I couldn't walk, and I couldn't do this, and I couldn't do that. And they went in, and they got the bullet out. And I think I still have that bullet. It a little bit of gristle grown all the way around that bullet, and it didn't bother me at all. I don't know what everybody got excited about.
So, Laura, you have a cat story?
When we were on that cabin in Crosman Ridge, far, far from anybody else, one evening, a cat came to the door. Meow. Of course, it got let in and got some milk and some bedding behind the stove. And next morning, it went to the door. It wanted to go out. And it was gone. That evening, the cat came back. Meow. Opened the door, and here's the cat with a kitten in its mouth. This happened two more days. So here we have a cat with three kittens, you know, little bitty guys. No idea whose cat it was. So my dad, next time he went to town, he mentioned this cat and described it and everything. And it turned out it belonged to the Martinis, who lived on West Hill, I can't think of the name of the place, but it's about halfway up that straight stretch before you get to the Y. So that cat traveled miles, 3 days in a row to, 4 days in a row, first to scope us out, and then three more trips to bring us the kittens. So we found out whose cat it was, so they got the cat and one kitten back, and my brother and I each got a kitten out of that deal. Can I tell the porcupine story at the same time? Okay. We came home from town one day, and one of the steers down in the pasture had a gray face. Went down to check it out, and he was just full of porcupine quills. And there was a fallen tree there. My dad got a rope, and he tied the steer so that his throat was on the log so he couldn't move. He got out his pliers, and he pulled out a quill, and that steer just went, and laid perfectly still for all the rest of those nasty quills to get out of him.
I was just going back to that cat story, going, well, if I was a cat and had a bunch of kittens to feed and I went by a homestead full of chickens, I think I'd find a place to live too. okay, Steve, you have any experience gold mining?
Well, not gold mining. Not, that wasn't quite the way that went. There was Andy and Alan Blatchford. They were twins. No, Johnny Blatchford. Johnny Blatchford was a nephew, their nephew. Jack Colley and myself. And we were in the fourth grade. And there was an old tar paper shack, which was situated right across from where Homer Insurance is now. It was just a one-room shack, and there was an old miner that lived in that shack, and he'd passed away and several years before us kids were in there. And the door was off, and the windows were broken out. And so us kids, we were in there, and there was a bunch of old magazines and stuff laying around. Everything was pretty well, anything of any value had been taken out of that little place. And anyway, we were a Bull Durham sack, and a Bull Durham is tobacco. And not the little sacks, but the big sack. And we were throwing this thing. We were playing catch with it. And I can't remember which one of us threw it. I know I was the one that was supposed to catch it, but I didn't. It hit the wall, and it fell down, and it broke open. And I went over to pick it up. And my grandmother had the Homer Cash store there in town here. And she had a mint number. And I'd seen gold. The miners, you couldn't own gold back then. You could mine it. You could sell it to the government. It was the government. You couldn't own gold. So $32 an ounce. And so I looked at this and I said, hey, guys, I think this is gold. And, little kids like that. So we rushed what spilled out of it back into this Bull Durham sack. But while we were doing that, we seen a leather pouch. There was a big leather pouch. Not a big leather pouch, but a leather pouch inside of this Bull Durham sack. Closest place of anybody with any authority was the schoolhouse. And Bill Wiltrout lived at the schoolhouse. And he was the principal, the coach, the history teacher, and whatever else he was at the time. And so we took this gold, we took this pouch to Bill Wiltrout, and 2 days later, that cabin was completely gone. 2 days after we'd found that. So anyway, the next year we're in the fifth grade. So Andy, there was no PA system in the schools in them days or anything like that. So Andy Blatchford got called into the principal's office, one at a time. Then Alan Blatchford got called in. Then
Johnny Blatchford got called in. Then Jack Colley got called in. And my name starting with a W, I got called in last. Well, by the time these other four got called in there, I'm thinking to myself, what did they do? And then I get called in and I go, I'm in. And I walk into the principal's office there, and there's Bill Wilter out there. And the state trooper at the time here was Frank Johnson, and he was there, standing there, and he had his hat on and his uniform and his fit polish shoes. And I'm going, oh, God, what'd we get caught at now, you know? Make a long story short, we got $527 apiece. They tried to find a relative of the miner, the old miner that passed away there. And I've been told that that price at $32 an ounce, that would have been worth $96,000 today. I got one more thing. In my mind, that miner walked from Homer every summer and came back to Homer in the fall. Where did he find that gold?
Christmas. We had three Christmases the first winter we were here. We had relatives in Washington, had no idea how long it took a package to get to us. So we had Christmas, we had Christmas, we had Christmas. Of course, there was no electricity. You didn't have lights on the tree, but you had decorations. And of course, the tree was out in the backyard anywhere handy. But my favorite present every year that my grandmother was alive was her package. She got the Seattle Times or whatever paper it was, and she saved the comics all year long, and we got this box of comics for Christmas.
I've been just watching the slideshow up there, and it was piling on the beach there. There was no trees big enough on the South Kenai Peninsula to make trap piling. We had to get those piling from Snug Harbor. Snug Harbor is across the inlet on the other side of Kelligan Island there. But what I want to bring up here is the beetles had come through in the 1880s and killed all the old growth trees. We cut a tree. I had somebody cut some trees out here on the Sterling Highway just outside of town. The oldest tree was germinated in 1510 that we cut after the beetles came through. It was only a 4-inch tree in the 1880s. So the beetles, about every 100 years, they come through and they kill off all the old growth trees, nature.
So we gotta wrap this up, but the big question is, what do you appreciate now about your homesteading childhood, and can you do it in about a minute?
I can do it in less than that. Freedom. As a kid here, that's the biggest thing I miss living here now, is we had a lot of freedom.
I'll echo the freedom thing. And also, as a family, we were a unit. Our parents were always right there in front of us, leading us off to work. But, you know, we were together. It was a real camaraderie. We knew we were loved and we knew we were needed. Because if we left home, the homestead would fold because two people could not feed all those chickens and hill all those potatoes and pitch all that hay. So it was good.
Well, boy, that wraps it up. And that gives us a pretty good feel for what life was like then.